Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is...
Jason Rosenbaum of the St. Louis Beacon.
Joe Manis of the St. Louis Beacon.
And Democratic Senator...
Scott Sifton, 1st Senate District.
The 1st Senate District.
He's number one.
Number yes. one. The 1st Senate District, and this is your first year in the Senate.
That's right. That's right. Served one term in the House before that and 9 years on the school board in Afton.
Tell us a little bit about it other than just it being number one.
Sure. Well, it's South St. Louis County and part of the inner suburban ring, and it takes in everything in South County east of I-55, between I-55 and the Mississippi River. Once you get up to Lindbergh, loosely Lindbergh becomes the boundary. Now, there are parts that are either west of Lindbergh and Kirkwood that are in. There are parts that are north of Lindbergh in South County that are out. But basically, Lindbergh is my southern and then western boundary going through Crestwood and into Kirkwood, a little bit of Sunset Hills. And then the northern front is the city of Rock Hill, the southern half of Brentwood, almost all of Maplewood, but it also takes in Webster Groves, Afton, most of Afton, Lemay, and what is the unincorporated area referred to as Concord. So 9 school districts and 182,000 people.
So you kind of alluded to before, you only served one term in the House before you engaged in what I would consider one of the biggest state Senate races of last year. It was really fun covering that race, by the way, because it was an example. And I've said this to you privately, but I'll say it to all the world.
The whole world's listening right now.
I found it to be a race between two excellent candidates who campaigned well, who had strong opinions, you and former Senator Jim Lemke of LeMay. Tell me a little bit about what that campaign was like and, you know, why you think you came out ahead.
Well, it was extremely hard work, as most campaigns are, but as you allude to, my opponent, tremendously hardworking candidate who had himself served 6 years in the House and 4 years in the Senate, had won, I think, his previous 4 elections, all of them by less than 1% of the vote. So he was no stranger to close calls. And we knew going into the campaign that to have a chance to win, we were going to have to give it our absolutely best effort because I had so much respect for my opponent's work ethic. So it was in a summer that was much hotter than this one, night in, night out, knocking on doors, working hard to build the resources we needed to communicate our message to the electorate. But at the end of the day, I think voters in the district wanted to see a greater emphasis placed on moving forward on economic development and tax credit reform legislation rather than insisting on the perfect package before letting anything happen. Lobbyist gifts were obviously an issue in the campaign as well. That said, I don't want to relitigate all that other than to say, I have nothing but the greatest respect for my opponent and the effort that he put in, and grateful to the voters of the 1st District for the opportunity to serve.
Well, you were notable in that your victory was virtually the only Democratic legislative victory in the state where you knocked off a Republican incumbent.
At least in the Senate, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and this was in 2012 when most of the Democrats, although in some case it was narrow, they did win statewide all but one office.
You know, what we've seen unfold in Missouri really over the last 20 years, and part of it's just how on the legislative map, how closely Democrats and Republicans live to one another. The phenomenon we've seen unfold is that Democrats have won the better part of 75% of the statewide races in the last 15 years, while at the same time the legislature has flipped from nearly two-thirds Democratic to now precisely two-thirds Republican. And a lot of that is just political geography of legislative districts.
Redistricting? Do you think districting helped the Republicans a lot?
You know, in the Senate, certainly not. I mean, the new map basically gave the Democrats a new seat, and certainly in the case of the 1st Senate District, I'd have to acknowledge that it was a different district than the one that elected my predecessor 4 years previous, without question. That's always a factor. That's the reason people pay attention to how the lines are drawn. In the House, I think it's fair to say that at least in my view, having worked fairly closely on House redistricting when I served in that chamber, that there's a range of different map scenarios. I think the map that we got is one that is relatively favorable to Republicans. I would also say that even the most favorable map to Democrats, just because of how densely Democratic districts are packed in, makes it very tough for us to see a Democratic majority in the House anytime soon.
I mean, so you think it could be a long, long – I mean, there's some people who think it could be, well, decades before the Democrats could get control of either chamber in Missouri.
On the current maps, there is a clearer path in the Senate than in the House. But as it stands now, we have 10 seats in the Senate, and frankly, we're going to have to work very hard in 2014 just to stay at that level.
Yeah, you could potentially lose seats hypothetically.
Yes.
So, but that gets us to, I guess, the question we're all dying to talk about, this veto session.
Yes,
we're only a few weeks away now.
Yes,
and
yes. For our junkies like ourselves,
there's been a lot of focus on what's going to happen in the House because 253, this tax cut bill that we've talked about incessantly, starts in the House.
As we should be.
As it should be. There's an open question about whether that bill or any other bill from the House, whether it be the quote-unquote gun nullification bill or any other bill that came out of there, is going to make it to the Senate. I think what we wanted to talk about with you is, as a member of a 10-person strong Democratic caucus, that if you band together and filibuster for a long time, you could hypothetically stop things. Generally, what is kind of your thoughts on how the Democrats will they'll do in September 11th when some of these bills come over?
And particularly in the Senate, since, I mean, most of the major bills are going to be starting in the House first.
You know, I think that largely remains to be seen. A lot is going to depend on what comes out of the House, if anything. And I say this every year, there is a very intense set of maneuvering that goes on about what veto session will or will not be comprised of. And, you know, my first year in the House, we called zero bills up for override. My second year, we called up one ultimately in the House, and there was only one override that came out of the Senate. And I didn't realize this until recently. It's apparently been a long, long time since the Senate has taken up a House bill for veto override. Now, that said, there's plenty of reason to think that could happen this year. A lot's going to depend on what comes out of the House. I will say that, initially the obvious override candidate was 253, the tax bill that the governor's been talking about all summer long. We all know that's going to be one that may very well be brought up for a vote in the House. If it comes out of the House, then we'll see what happens in the Senate. The gun bill that you mentioned, Jason, there's been talk of late. I think the Speaker mentioned the Doe Run bill as another possibility. And actually, in the last few days, the list seems to be getting a little bit longer.
I've noticed that.
You know, it talks about the sex offender bill. And Chris and I were at the news conference today that the governor had, where the governor really – actually, I haven't seen him that passionate on something, except maybe 253. He really unloaded.
He was.
And he was really, this is 301 is the sex offender bill, which would in effect remove people under the age of 18 who are on the sex offender list from the rolls if that's if they just have the one-off, one sex offense. The problem is, he says, is because it doesn't include other crimes. So he had big pictures of people who were on the sex offender rolls who actually had been convicted of murder and other things that he said would be removed from the rolls under the bill.
And he estimates that it would be 870 individuals who would be removed from the rolls.
Yeah, and he was really whipped up about it. So
yeah.
I was curious, I mean, which is stunning, and he really went after the Speaker on it, saying that the Speaker has been cavalier in some of his language. Is that some stuff that's been rather surprising in the last few days, or what have you been hearing? You mentioned that there's been some communications within the Senate lately.
Well, actually, the communications in the Senate have been about a separate bill which pertains to uninsured motorists. But and the other Senate communication that we've received is just an indication from the floor leader that, we do have time set for Thursday and Friday of the week of veto session. You know, if nothing's taken up, we'll be there Wednesday and in and out relatively quickly, most likely depending on what comes out of the House and how long it takes them. But the majority floor leader on the Senate has indicated, you know, we'll get started at 10 o'clock on Thursday and Friday if we're still here, which we could be. Mm-hmm. But as to the sex offender bill, you know, I would anticipate, in light of some of what the governor has raised, that folks may take a long, hard look as to whether this is something that would be appropriate to bring up for an override, or instead perhaps take into account the concerns the governor has raised and revisit the issue again in January. I think that the governor has made some important points that need to be weighed very carefully. Certainly on an override question and or in the legislative process regardless.
On the gun bill, which we've been talking about, are you surprised there seems to be a better chance as of now of that getting overridden than, say, the tax cut bill? I've noticed by reading, you know, a lot of accounts that a lot of Republicans want to override it, some Democrats want to override it, even though there's no real evidence, for example, that this is a quote-unquote gun lobby pushed bill. It seems like people are kind of falling over themselves to override this. Why do you think that is in many ways?
You know, from a certain standpoint, you know, depending on what happens with the tax bill and some of these other bills, there is, as we saw 2 years ago, always the possibility at the end of the day there may not be the votes there to override much of anything. And I think the nature of the gun bill is such that it's one that, given the fact that in many ways gun policy is a bipartisan issue in this state, or really more a nonpartisan issue in the state, and perhaps, if anything, a regional issue, that might be the one that there are most likely to be the votes to override on, you know, regardless of the fact that I think many have acknowledged, and the Post, I think, wrote up one of our state representatives on it, many have acknowledged that it's unconstitutional on its face.
Yeah, we probably should explain to our listeners that this bill would, in effect, bar enforcement of all federal gun laws, including the 1934 ban on machine guns. And
it would also prohibit publishing names of
gun owners. And the governor is claiming that the way it's worded, that anybody, even a little feature of a kid who just got his first gun and shot a deer could...
And it also features a number of other things. It
lists
concealing carry from 21 to 19, has something with open carry, it has something with gun buyback programs. And there's a big question of whether all that stuff will survive if parts are declared unconstitutional.
It also has language quite literally putting guns in the hands of teachers. And I think the governor, I mean, true to his word in vetoing the bill, was clear early after the Sandy Hook incident, tragedy in December, that, you know, putting guns in teachers' hands was not something he supported. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think the people in the first Senate district support it, and I don't think the people in Missouri support it either. So I, you know, no secret here. I voted against the bill the first time around. It's my intent to vote to sustain the governor's veto if it gets that far.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from people in your district, like regarding 253, which, you know, cuts taxes but also eliminates the exemption on prescription drugs? Sales tax on prescription drugs, so they would be paying sales taxes on that and on textbooks. You were at the governor's event a week ago at the drugstore in Kirkwood.
Right. And
were you at the bank, too?
I was at Commerce Bank as well. So fiscal conservatives
there
should
have been
be
a lot of them.
Yeah, fiscal conservatives should be concerned about 253 because of what it means for the state's credit rating potentially. It could increase borrowing costs at a time when we're contemplating $1 billion road ballot question and $1 billion state building bond issue. You know, we're talking about a measure that would possibly increase our borrowing costs for both of those, and I think that would be a mistake. It's a terrible bill for seniors in several respects. And my district has a lot of folks who are living on a fixed income, very modestly, who can barely afford prescription drugs as it stands now, and who would be hit very hard by this bill. And the other thing that many of them are having a hard time covering is their local school property tax bill. The average school district in my legislative district receives between 85% and 90% of its funding from local property taxpayers rather than through the state foundation formula. So the property tax burden, especially on seniors living on fixed incomes in my district, is disproportionately great compared to many other places in the state. And this bill is bad for local property taxpayers, because what it's going to do, our state education formula is already underfunded by more than $500 million. By limiting state income growth over the next 10 years to basically 1%, and I can explain more about that in a minute, it is inevitable that local school boards are going to turn to local property taxpayers to continue to cover just the inflationary costs, increases in providing education, which is a pretty hot topic certainly in my district, in the St. Louis region these days, and I think statewide with the accreditation issues that we're seeing a number of districts have, and all the that gets into the transfer issue. But long story short, 253 is going to substantially curtail the state's ability to support K-12 and higher education, and that's bad for local property taxpayers and for parents of college students and for college students.
Now, one of the other big stories from this summer has been the school transfer situation, where you have students coming from unaccredited school districts going to accredited ones paid for by the unaccredited districts. One of the big complaints about this about this 20-year-old law is that it doesn't set very many guidelines and it doesn't give a lot of guidance. What do you see the legislature doing next year in terms of the transfer situation?
I see the legislature focusing very intently on the issue, not from the first day of session, but from the first day of pre-filing and actually before. Conversations have been happening really ever since the court decision, certainly in the last few weeks as developments have unfolded. Folks are talking. The patient is going to be on the table from the opening gavel in January.
What sort of surgery are we talking about?
Right,
because you put forth some specific ideas. Since Melville is one of the, I guess Riverview Gardens people are going to Melville.
That's in your district.
Yes.
And the number actually between Melville and Kirkwood, which I also represent, between the two districts, it happens to be an even 400 transfers. The last number we heard from Melville was 216, and in Kirkwood, the number as of the first day of school yesterday was 184. I have called for having somebody besides the transferring district decide where transportation dollars are provided for. And I say that arguably the statute doesn't even allow the transferring district any discretion. Arguably, under the statute, they have to pay the cost of transportation to every district. Now, that's not what's happening. That's not what DESE's guidelines call for. There's an argument to be made that that's a loss. We've got to address that. But I just don't think the transferring district is in the best position to make that determination. I think that should be done at a regional or even statewide level. And by the way, we could see additional unaccredited districts in the St. Louis region in the years ahead. We already have the city of Kansas City's schools unaccredited and some outstate districts that are on the watch list. So this is an issue that is going to be looming larger, not smaller, in the months and years ahead. There's some concern in the case of Normandy whether they'll even be financially solvent by the time the legislature convenes in January. Beyond that, the law needs to have some kind of recognition for the capacity of receiving districts. I mean, I this is a touch melodramatic, and it's sort of a hypothetical, but I served on a school board of a 2,500 student district that happens to be adjacent to two other districts that are similarly sized, and across the river to Pear, we have a district with maybe 55,000 school-aged children, and I don't think you'd ever see the day when, God forbid, if the city schools were to lose their accreditation again, that 55,000 students would say we're all coming to this particular 2,500 student district. But under the current law, there's nothing to prevent that.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
They're only provisionally accredited right now.
I live in southwest St. Louis City in St. Louis Hills, which is a fairly middle-class affluent area. And as soon as that district becomes unaccredited, you're going to see people like those as well as low-income people going to Clayton, going to Afton, going to any nearby places, and they will transfer out of there. And I think it will make this situation look like a picnic in many respects.
And I think in that regard, we have to craft the legislative solution in mind that what we're not talking about, we're not just talking about two districts, plus Kansas City. We're talking about something that, with increasing accountability in K-12 education in our state is something that, you know, will will happen to districts that aren't getting the job done for every one of their kids. And you know, to your point, Jason, the reality is children everywhere deserve a quality education regardless of the, you know, of what you know, the local resources are, or what the local board does, or what the local administration does, or what's happening in the classroom with professional development. We need to get the job done. This region is not going to be able to compete in the 21st century if we cannot provide a quality education to all of our students, and we have got to get that done. So we need to address transportation. We need to address capacity. We also need to address the financial solvency or lack thereof of the transferring districts. You know, what I have been struck by in discussing this issue with constituents is the one theme that has been constantly recurring is, what can we do here in South St. Louis County, or as a matter of policy in Jefferson City, to get, you know, the Normandies and the Riverviews back to where they need to be in providing a quality education, apart from keeping them financially solvent, if that's in the cards. What do we need to do to provide a good education in those buildings? Because 75% of the students in those districts are still there, and you know, we need answers. DESE has begun work on that. They've made some steps even just in the last day or two. We got an email this morning about some steps that they're taking pursuant to one bill that the legislature already has passed, Senate Bill 125, that allows DESE to intervene sooner rather than later in unaccredited districts. So DESE is going to be working on this. The legislature is going to be working on this. I would hope that between the two we can get the job done and not continue to have the judiciary in the driver's seat on this by default because the other two branches of government aren't getting their job done.
Do you think this might get intertwined in this back and forth between the quote-unquote educational establishment, as they're derisively called, and reformers, as they're more, you know, subtly called, that want better access to private schools or tuition tax credits or any of those things?
Or they want to eliminate teacher tenure.
Or stuff like that. That seems to be why the quote-unquote Turner fix didn't make it last time. It got intertwined in that. Do you see that happening again next year?
You know, I think the history of this issue, you know, I think the real reason Turner didn't at least come to a vote was because the courts told us the law was unconstitutional at the time. And I think that unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly, killed the momentum toward getting it done. I didn't have the power to bring it to a vote in the House, but it didn't get brought to a vote. It should have. But the court decision being timed about, what, 10 days out from the end of session in 2012, I can tell you, just killed the momentum to get that done. And it was unfortunate because we didn't get the second ruling until after it was too late for the legislature to do anything in 2013. I mean, we spent the entire 2013 session thinking the law was unconstitutional. But to your question, Jason, I think the history of this issue has been that, unfortunately, there has been some overreaching on both sides. I think folks that want to see change have been asking for too much. I think people that want to see the status quo and solve this all with a blank check have been too stubborn. And I think the truth lies somewhere in between. And you know, in 1 year in the Missouri Senate, I have learned that in some ways it's not the institution a lot of people might expect it to be. You know, we talk about 34 islands in the Senate. We talk about the independence of senators. And I can tell you, certainly the St. Louis regional delegation on both sides of the aisle is determined to get something moving and get something done on this. And I don't think you're going to see ideologues on either side of the issue. I think you're going to see people working across the aisle, rolling up their sleeves, trying to come up at what the best policy is for transferring districts, for receiving districts, and for districts that might be performing at a high level now but might have a building that has a problem, which right now, you know, the accreditation runs district-wide. If you fail as a district because of three schools out of 20, you fail as a district. On the other hand, if you're accredited as a district, despite having three out of 20 schools be underperforming, you have – you know, really no accountability to try to force improvements in the buildings that are failing. So one of the other issues that we're looking very closely at is whether we ought to take up accreditation on a building-by-building level rather than district-by-district. Mm-hmm. That's one of the issues that's on the table. But, I think most of us are of the view that, you know, this is not the time for us to be ideological. This is the time for us to be pragmatic and to solve the challenge that is before us.
Now, we're going to enter new ground in political speaking, because always we've talked about tax cuts and state-level bills with state-level people. But
I don't know where we're going with this.
The person sitting next to me has gotten involved in a county-level issue, which is my journalistic territory, so to speak, in that he has spoken out in the situation in Oakville, which is in his Senate district, involving a low-income senior housing development there. Just to sum up for the readers that don't know about it, a company out of Columbus, Ohio, last year got permission to build a three-story low-income senior housing facility there. Right around the time this year, I think it was in May, there started to be a lot of public backlash in Oakville against that because they felt they did not have proper notification when this situation was going through. And the reason why I am prefacing this is because Senator Sifton to my left is one of the people who has spoken out, I guess, with some of the residents who have been upset about this, along with Representative Marcia Haefner of Oakville, a Republican, and a lot of other people. So having said that verbose introduction, why did you decide to get involved in this? And what do you see the issues at play that people are so mad about?
You know, in visiting with constituents in Oakville, it became apparent to me very early on that this was in no way some kind of partisan issue. This was a local land use issue that was of critical importance to a great many. And when I say a great many, I'm talking about thousands of people that I represent. And I there are people that I talk with about different issues at different times. I mean, just the other day, I was talking to somebody about who's concerned about telecommunications policy, who happens to live just off of Telegraph Road, and was asking me what the prospects were going forward. I mean, folks are concerned about this for several different reasons. The biggest one is just local land use, and bear in mind, you know, for the folks in Oakville, their land use decisions are made in Clayton.
Yes, because it's unincorporated, and effectively the county council is their city council.
Correct.
It's about 40 minutes to drive from the site of this development to the building, the county government building where the issue was decided. And that can be frustrating for folks, especially when the development in question is a three-story development and will basically be the tallest non-industrial use in the 63129 zip code. Oakville, to this point, has always been a development of no more than two stories. Moreover, this is a fairly intense use on a relatively small lot. There's concern about the sufficiency of parking. The development in question is also adjacent to a daycare. In fact, shares a fence. The dumpster is on the other side of the fence line from the playground. I mean, they're right on top of each other. And so there were issues of proximity to the daycare and a school and a monastery of cloistered nuns who came forward publicly, cloistered nuns testifying publicly.
It was a sight to see.
Yeah.
He's not making this up. This really happened.
And all I would say, you know, I've got a decision rule about crime and law enforcement legislation that I might introduce. If there's any chance that somebody wearing a badge is going to testify against my bill, it's not going to get filed because I'm not looking to do anything to make law enforcement's job harder for them. I would also say respectfully to developers, look, if you have nuns testifying against you at a zoning hearing, you've done something wrong and the outreach here was lacking. And, you know, I don't want to cast aspersions onto how all this happened, but long story short, the Oakville community was absolutely united on this issue, and I wanted to stand next to a Republican state representative and a Democratic county council member, one, in asking that we at least get these folks a hearing since clearly they didn't know this was going on the first time around, and two, when the time came for the hearing, to make it clear this is not a partisan issue. This is representing the Oakville community, and as their state senator, that's my job. What am I there for if I'm not going to speak for the people? And there are two sides to every issue. There were some concerns about liability to the county in the event the zoning determination were to be changed, and that's something the commission took into account. They voted against changing the zoning, and it's my understanding that the county council doesn't seem to have much appetite to take the issue any further.
So in other words, it will get built.
Well, as it stands now, it's been being built. I mean, one of the frustrations with this was at the time of the first county council meeting where the issue was raised, the foundation had already been poured.
Yeah, it's being built right now. So continue.
So, you know, in that regard, it's frustrating. And you know, I still stand where I stand on the issue. Assuming the project goes forward from this point, all I will say is thousands of people who felt let down by local government got to ask for a hearing and got to be heard. And even though none of them are happy with the outcome, ultimately, at least they had their elected representatives standing up on their behalf and getting them what process they could. I'm not satisfied with that. It's not the outcome that I hoped for. But as compared to county government simply refusing to even hear these people, right, who are very concerned about something they think is inappropriate for their community, we at least accomplished that.
Okay.
I guess we'll just touch on this very briefly, right, because we said we would, about ethics, because that was a major issue in your campaign. You have proposed banning all lobbyist gifts. You've spoken before about how you're not pleased that Missouri has no limits on gifts, on campaign contributions. There was a third thing. Was it travel or something like that?
That goes in with lobbyist gifts.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, travel. There's also the whole thing about intercommittee transfers of money.
So really, we wanted to touch on this. Where do you see that issue going? I know Senator Lamping was on our show and says he wants to focus on that next session, which may be his last session. But where do you see that issue going next year?
You know, Senator Lamping had a bill this year that made it to the floor for about 45 minutes before it was pulled. And not to be, not to be critical here, but it's great to talk about ending the revolving door between legislators and lobbyists. But, you know, when Democratic amendments to reinstate campaign donation limits were brought to the floor and roll called, with my lobbyist gift ban waiting in the wings, and that's why the bill gets pulled from the floor, I was just very disappointed that we did not get to have a full debate of the merits of all of these proposals. If folks want to make the case for accepting lobbyist gifts, let them put their name on the record. I just think it looks terrible. And people can give their justifications for accepting lobbyist gifts, and if they think that's what's called for. I just think what's the number? I mean, was it $750,000?
It was $750,000 just for the session.
Yeah, and that's for the first 5 months out of the year.
It's gone up to about $800,000.
And we wonder why people are cynical about their government when they see all of that going on. And, I just think there's absolutely no reason it should be the case, especially during session when, by the way, taxpayers are giving us $100 a day for meals and lodging in a town where rent is $250 a month. If you can't afford to feed yourself three times a day on $100 taxpayer dollars, you probably don't need to be trying to figure out a $23 billion budget. It's an issue of credibility of the legislature. And there's just no reason why the institution should continue to allow itself to be basically tarnished in this way. I mean, there's just no reason for it to be.
Are you hopeful at all that next session there will be some serious work done on it?
I would hope so. I know that there's talk of an initiative petition, at least on donation limits, right, that may include some other ethics reforms. The unfortunate history of this has been that, you know, we've seen some comprehensive ethics legislation make it to the finish line, only to be struck down by the courts in a way that respectfully might have been foreseeable from the people pushing it in the first place. And that's very unfortunate. But I certainly will work with any of my Senate colleagues and anybody in the House to try to get common sense ethics reform in Missouri. We have the most, or at least one of the most lax environments of any state in the nation, and that just doesn't speak well of our state.
Okay, one last question,
sure,
is, and we mentioned this to you before we went on the air, although you've only been in the Senate 1 year and you had a term in the House, you're already being talked about as a potential candidate, perhaps as a Democratic candidate for state auditor in 2014, because the Democrats still seem to be looking for somebody to run against incumbent Tom Schweik. Or 2016, when there's a whole raft of statewide mm-hmm. offices up. Anything you want to say?
Well, I appreciate the question, Joe. As a first-year senator, having spent much of my summer on the housing development in Oakville and the transfer issue, my constituents should know that I am 100% focused on the legislative matters in front of me and serving them. And that's my focus.
I think we'll leave it at that. we were trying to get super breaking news out of you, but we'll just have to do with your thoughtful approach to issues for now.
Yeah, but the Ron Richard note, that's news.
Yes. Well, that should just about do it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. Who do we have on next week?
Oh, former Speaker Steve Tilley.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Republican.
That's right.
You'll enjoy that.
It's good. I'm actually really pumped for that. I'm not even being sarcastic. So, Tilly, if you're listening, get ready. We're going to have a good time.
Well, we'll be back next week. You can read all of my stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can read all of Joe and Jason's stories at stlbeacon.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
Jay Rosenbaum.
You can follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's J M A N N I E S.
And you can follow the senator on Twitter at.
Well, I'm sure there is a link on my website, scottsifton.com. I'm not so much a Twitterer.
Very good. Well, we'll be back next week. Until then, so long.